Welcome back to the program. One of the central tenets of the debate about religion is that some claim it provides the only construct for understanding moral behavior. In fact, science and research and even our own pets should tell us clearly that empathy, cooperation, fairness, and reciprocity are all traits we see in animal behavior, particularly the primate. Just as the monstrous instinct exists in all of us, including animals, so too do the traits of social cooperation. In fact, it's simply the other side of the same coin. No one has done a better job of explaining this than my guest, Franz de Waal. Franz de Waal is a biologist and primatologist known for his work on the behavior and social intelligence of primates. His first book, Chimpanzee Politics, compared the schmoozing and scheming of chimps involved in power struggles with that of human politicians. He's drawn parallels between primate and human behavior. His scientific work has been published in hundreds of articles and journals such as Science, Nature, and Scientific America. Franz de Waal is the C.H. Candler Professor in the Psychology Department at Emory University and the author of the new book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Franz de Waal, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be there.
Delight to have you here. How did we ever stumble on this idea, in fact, that somehow we operated for years with this notion that all animal behavior, anything that went on, was entirely selfish by nature?
Well, I think that was a sort of, in the 70s and 80s, that was the main theme, you know, selfish genes, all competition. We humans, we fell under that, and we would also argue that human behavior is entirely selfishly motivated, even though you can see around you that's not always the case. And so that was a very dominant theme in biology, and it trickled down to everybody else. And it's around the year 2000 that everything started to change, because the neuroscientists were finding that we take pleasure in our brains from doing good for others. And the economists were finding that humans were actually quite a bit more cooperative than they had expected. And primatologists such as myself, we were finding that animals have empathy and actually care about each other. And so this whole picture started to change, and now we don't think like that anymore.
Yeah, and part of it is simply, as I said in the introduction, the other side of the same coin, understanding that whether it's in the animal world or among bonobos or among people, that the minute you create some kind of a social order, you're going to have things like empathy and cooperation as part of the mix.
Well, it's the way many animals survive. Many animals survive by cooperating. And so if you live in a group, like almost all the primates live in groups, and they survive. They don't survive very well outside of groups. We know that. And so they live in a group for a reason. And as soon as you live in a group, you need to worry about others because you depend on them. So if someone is injured or distressed, that's actually not beneficial for you. You might think if everything is based on competition, it's actually good if you get rid of one of your competitors. But, you know, if you survive by cooperating, it's not such a great thing to get rid of your competitors.
Talk a little bit about this whole notion of how this relates to what we see in evolutionary biology and the way this has evolved over time.
Yeah, we think that the two basic tendencies that underlie human morality, which are, on the one hand, empathy and compassion and caring about others, and on the other hand is the sense of justice and the sense of fairness, that both of them are related to living in cooperative groups. And actually, empathy, we think, probably started with maternal care. And because whether you're a female mouse or a female elephant, you need to respond to the emotional signals of your offspring. Otherwise, you're going to lose your offspring. So when they're hungry, when they're cold or in danger, you need to respond to them. And so there's a high evolutionary pressure on females responding to their young. And that's also why probably empathy is more developed in women than in men, and this is true for many other species as well. And that's also why oxytocin, which is a maternal hormone, if you spray oxytocin in the nostrils of both men and women, they become more empathic. And so we think that these maternal tendencies then sort of spread to other relationships, so that also men could have it and people could have it towards friends and so on. And that's what you see in lots of animals also. For example, the reason many animals have mammals at home, like dogs and cats, and not reptiles like turtles or iguanas, is precisely because we are very affected by the emotional signals of others, and we appreciate that these animals are sensitive to our emotional signals, and that's not what you have with a turtle, for example.
And these ideas of reciprocity and empathy then become the cornerstone of any kind of moral behavior.
Yeah, I would not necessarily say that, let's say, a chimpanzee or a bonobo is moral in the human sense, but many of the capacities that we have built into our moral systems are primate capacities. And so we care about others. We are sensitive to fair distributions or unfair distributions. We test that with our primates, for example. We do tests where they get different rewards for the same task, and the one who gets the lesser reward is usually not happy about that. And so we test fairness principles in our primates. And so a lot of these tendencies, these basic tendencies, are actually older than our species, and certainly older, and that's one of the arguments in my book, certainly older than our current religions, which are only like 2,000 or 3,000 years old.
One of the other ways that you see this playing out is the ways in which these animals reconcile after conflict. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, I think that's how actually my research started on this topic, is that I noticed that after chimpanzees have a fight, and something very surprising happens, is that they approach each other, the two opponents approach each other, and then all of a sudden they embrace and kiss. And the first time I saw this is a very long time ago that I saw this for the first time, no one had ever told me that that's what you had to expect in animals. And no one was actually looking for that kind of behavior, because everyone at that time assumed that the only thing that mattered is if you win or lose the fight. So if you win, it's good, of course. If you lose, it's bad. And what happens afterwards is totally irrelevant. But I noticed that they kiss and embrace. And if you look at bonobos, we notice that they have sex afterwards. And if you look at monkeys, you notice that they groom afterwards. And so all these species, and actually it has now been found in tons of species, in dolphins and wolves and goats, and lots of species have these reconciliations where they repair the relationship after conflict between them, which means that they find their relationship very important, which means that despite all the conflict that happens in a group, and that's sort of inevitable, despite that, they feel these relationships need protection, and they need to care about them, and they will repair them, and they will do a long grooming session with their biggest rival, if that's necessary, to repair the relationship.
Well, talk about the nexus between free will and this kind of behavior in the animal kingdom, and what we understand about that.
I'm not sure that I know what free will is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for many people.
Right.
We can all speculate what it is, but... There are some experiments that are sort of interesting in that regard, because some philosophers have defined free will as meaning that you consciously can go against your own impulses. Let's say my impulse is to beat you up, for example, and consciously I decide, well, that's not a good thing to do. Maybe I'll get into trouble and so on. Or maybe I'll take a different strategy and try to talk with you or something like that. And so that's all considered free will if you go against your impulses. And there are actually experiments on this in primates where people, for example, do delayed gratification. I don't know if you know what it is, but
mm-hmm.
with children they do the famous marshmallow test.
Right.
You put one child behind the table, you say, here's a marshmallow. If you don't touch it while I'm away, you'll get a second one. And so the child is very tempted. And many children will, for example, lick the marshmallow, or they will try not to look at it, and they look away from it, and they start playing with other things in order to not be tempted by the marshmallow. And that's a sort of act of free will, because they have an impulse to eat that thing, but they're consciously, deliberately controlling the impulse. Now, in primates, this kind of studies has been done. So, for example, this orangutan, there's a study where you put an orangutan in front of a container, and every 30 seconds there's a little candy that falls in the container. And as long as they don't touch the container, these things will be coming. And so the container gets fuller and fuller, and at some point they will grab it and eat it, and then, of course, the stream of candy stops. But there are apes who are willing to wait for 20 minutes to do that, which is about as long as children can handle the marshmallow test. And so, and we also have found that if you give them distractors, if you give them something to play with, they are better capable of controlling that impulse. And so free will, if it's defined that way, but of course some people disagree with that, but if that's how you define it, then it's not entirely uniquely human.
There's also the aspect with respect to gratification. Research has found that mammals, both man and animals, derive pleasure from helping others.
Yeah, that's for humans, of course, we have now brain research that shows that the pleasure centers in the brain lighten up when you give to charity, for example, which is all very interesting because it means that that whole line between selfish behavior and altruistic behavior, we like to make a dichotomy between those two. But that's actually probably nonsense because even altruistic behavior has some sort of pleasurable component to it. And so I always feel that distinction between selfish and altruistic has been exaggerated. Now, in other primates, we do actually experiments to see if they're willing to help others. And we assume, but that's not proven, but we assume that they also derive pleasure from it. And so one of the tests that we do is we bring chimpanzees in a situation where one chimpanzee can select between two tokens that they need to exchange with us. One token is of a color that indicates that if they exchange it with us, they get rewarded themselves only, but not their partner who is sitting next to them. The other token has a different color, and if they select that one, they get a reward, but their partner also gets a reward. And then we look over time, we do this many times in a row, we look which one do they prefer of the two. And over time, they start to prefer the token that rewards the two of them instead of just themselves, which shows that they have an interest in getting food for the partner as well. Other people have done completely different tests. So, for example, one test was with bonobos, where a bonobo gets a pile of fruits, and he can eat it all by himself. But there's also a door next to him, behind which sits another bonobo, and they have learned how to open the door. And so then the one who has the food can also open the door and let the other one in and then share the food. And that's actually what they prefer. They prefer to open the door. They lose half their food in the process to the other one who comes in, but they're willing to do that. And so there's now five or six of these tests that have been conducted on primates that show that they actually do care about the well-being of others.
One of the interesting things about this, and maybe this is human nature in its own way, that we want to blame bad behavior on evolutionary biology and we want to blame good behavior on something that is uniquely human.
Yeah, that's a sort of general tendency. If people act badly, for example, they kill each other or they put a bomb next to the marathon in Boston or something, we say they're acting like animals. So as soon as people do bad things, they're acting like animals. If you do good things, you send money to a victim of something or you help somebody, then we call it humane behavior and we claim that for ourselves. And I'm very strongly opposed to that kind of thinking because I believe that both the good tendencies and the bad tendencies that we have, they are all primate tendencies. And we can see both in other primates. I mean, other primates are not necessarily always nice with each other. They also sometimes kill each other, so they're acting like animals also in that sense.
And this has been something, I mean, since Darwin even, looking at this impact of morality in the whole animal-human continuum.
Yeah, Darwin believed very strongly that there was continuity. So the biologists in the 70s and the 80s who told us that morality and altruism are not really possible for the human species, that the genuine kindness doesn't really exist, they were not in tune with Darwin because Darwin himself, he had written about how morality is an evolved characteristic, how sympathy and empathy can probably be found in other animals. He wrote a whole book about the emotions, pointing out how similar the emotions of humans and other animals are. And so Darwin believed very strongly that evolution and morality were compatible with each other. And nowadays, of course, you hear sometimes people say that if you believe in evolution, that you don't believe in morality, as if these two things are not compatible. But that's not really how we biologists think about it.
Talk a little more about that and the importance of the social construct, the social overlay in this, and how it's different in groups of animals or individual animals, as you were touching on before, that don't exist in as large a social framework?
Well, it is a general mammalian characteristic to care about others. I'm not sure that many other animals, like, let's say, fish, I don't think they necessarily have that kind of caring tendencies that we find in the mammals who respond to distress of others. And so mammals, they have these responses even to individuals who are not of their own species. So, for example, dolphins sometimes help human swimmers to shore, things like that. And we humans, we help a whale, a stranded whale, back into the ocean. And so empathy actually can bridge the species divide and can bridge all sorts of divides. But empathy is also biased. So it's easier for us to have empathy with individuals from our group or individuals who are similar to us or family of us. And empathy with strangers or outgroup members is always a bit of a challenge. And so this has been tested. We do, for example, we do tests of a behavior that we call yawn contagion. You're influenced by the yawns of others, which corresponds with empathy because it uses that same body channel that empathy uses, and it relates to it. So people who are very high on empathy are people who are also very sensitive to the yawns of other people. That has been tested. And we do yawn contagion studies with chimpanzees. And chimpanzees, when they see a video of a chimpanzee yawning, they start to yawn themselves. And we present them, for example, videos of chimps that they know, so individuals who live in their own group, and we test also chimps that they don't know, chimps that they have never seen before. And their yawn contagion actually only works with individuals that they know. And this has been found in humans also. People have done field studies on humans. This was in Italy, where they looked at waiting rooms and train stations, who yawns when somebody else is yawning, and they found it works actually only between family members or good friends who are together. It doesn't work between strangers. And so this is sort of general characteristic of empathy, is it is much easier to have it for individuals who are similar to you or close to you, but it has the capacity to cross that divide.
Where does intellect fit into the equation and the development of the prefrontal cortex, for example, in humans? How does that interface with all that we've been talking about?
Well, the prefrontal cortex is often invoked as the place that inhibit certain impulses that allows us to regulate or control our impulses. What is interesting to know is that the human prefrontal cortex is not exceptional. So it used to be assumed always that we had the biggest one relative to the rest of the brain, but actually apes is just as big as in us relative to the rest of the brain. And basically, I think in all the primates, it's very similar. So humans have maybe more control over impulses, that's possible, than other animals, but it's certainly not that only humans can control their emotions and that animals always react to their emotions. Because, for example, if you're, let's say, a chimpanzee and you live in a chimpanzee society, there's a strict hierarchy, which means that low-ranking males, if they want to mate with a female, they may be very aroused by a certain female, but they cannot express that behavior. They need to inhibit it and wait for the right opportunity when the high-ranking males are out of sight, and they will do that. And so if you live in a hierarchy, there's all sorts of things that you need to inhibit if you want to stay out of trouble. And so emotional inhibitions are not uniquely human. They're found in many animals. And maybe humans are a little bit better at it. I have no idea. I don't think anyone has tested that, but that's a possibility.
One of the things that we're still trying to understand, where is the cutting edge of the research on all of this now?
Well, I think since now there are a few studies of empathy in rodents, so people have started testing these ideas in mice and rats. We're probably going to get genetic studies on empathy. Because, of course, with mice, as opposed to with chimpanzees, which are so hard to breed, with mice it's very easy to breed. And so then people start doing genetic studies and maybe more brain research than is possible in some of these other animals. And I think that's where some of that research is going at the moment.
Franz de Waal, the book is The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. It's just out from W.W. Norton. Franz, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.